Chapter 10. The Takedown. No matter what else was happening with Donald's presidency, Melania's initiative, or my feelings of frustration, Melania and I never stopped face-blowing kisses emojiing. On January 6th, in a series of tweets, Donald said, "I went from very successful businessman to top TV star to the President of the United States on my first try. I think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very stable genius at that." I sent Melania a link to an article about his remark, and she texted the nerd face emoji, which we use to denote goofy affection for each other. It was a favorite of ours, along with the squinting tongue face emoji. The Mueller investigation was in full swing. The country was deeply divided, but we were faced with tears of joy emojiing. It was all silliness, until things turned weary face emoji. First warning. On January 11, 2018, over in the East Wing, Lindsay swung by my office and asked, "Are you free now by any chance to meet with Heather?" She was referring to Heather Martin, formerly the Presidential Inauguration Committee's Director of Budget and Treasury, currently the Chief Financial Officer in the Office of the Administration. I stood up and together we walked down the hallway. Along the way, we knocked on Ricky's door and the three of us met Heather in Lindsay's East Wing corner office. "Heather," I shouted, "it's so good to see you." We all hugged her hello. We shared a common bond. We were all willing participants with leading roles in the planning of the 58th presidential inauguration. "Did they make your position full-time yet?" Lindsay asked Heather. "Not yet," she said. "It's worrying me." Back then, she worked part-time for Joe Hagan in the West Wing, overseeing Melania's budget. I asked Melania if we should hire her to keep her close, since she knew everything about the presidential inauguration committees and the White House's finances. But Melania said, "No way." The purpose of the meeting was to talk about the imminent filing of the Form 990. I thought to myself, here we go again, the one-pager. Heather reported the Presidential Inauguration Committee had filed several filing extensions, which had delayed releasing the 990 for nearly a year. The Presidential Inauguration Committee and the White House were under pressure from the press about the timing of the release. She said that Barrack's office and the White House were keeping track of all the press requests. The Washington Post and other media outlets were working on stories. Heather's mission in bringing us all together? We want to be prepared to mitigate any negative press the 990 release may generate for the First Lady, she said. I was on the edge of my chair with anticipation. What's been the focus? I asked. Are you concerned? Ricky asked Heather. We stared at one another. Wiz Media Partners was preparing the one-pager. I had known this day would come. But why was this about Melania? Heather walked us through the Presidential Inauguration Committee's year-long process of preparing the Form 990. She told us she'd been working with Tom Barrack, Treasurer Douglas Ammerman, and Rick Gates on its preparation. Despite Rick Gates' indictment, he was still involved in the 990 filing. My spidey senses were going full tilt. I was practically a tarantula by now. She explained, "It's taking longer than they expected." "Why?" I asked. "Apparently, Barrack and Ammerman were having a rough time preparing the form because the actual numbers didn't add up." That set off a sudden headache. The numbers were the numbers. Why didn't they add up? Heather told us the two main areas of concern, which hadn't escaped the notice of the press, were Tom's chairman's global dinner and Mark Burnett's close involvement at every stage of the presidential inaugural planning. Sitting there with Ricky and Lindsay and listening to Heather talk about the Presidential Inauguration Committee's financials was surreal. "What's been your response so far?" I asked. Heather said, "No comment," and we all nervously laughed. "What do they want to know about Mark?" I asked. "If he was paid," Heather said. That was the million-dollar question. I flashed back to that weeks-ago phone call I'd had with Tom about writing a one-pager about the pick. When he asked how John and I would like to see the story covered on the front page of the Washington Post, I thought he had meant it ironically. Heather informed us that Tom Barrack's advisor, Tommy Davis, former chief spokesperson for the Church of Scientology, son of actor Ann Archer and friend of Tom Cruise, had been fending off media requests that asked, "Where's the 990?" for months. "And the budget breakout?" I asked. "No, not necessary," Heather said. "We only list the top five vendors, no individual names." As far as the 990 was concerned, Wiz Media Partners was listed at number one, the top vendor. Hearing all this, a kernel of worry lodged in my gut, but I told myself that, however obtuse the 990 would be, Wiz Media was safe because John Reinaga and Mel Johnson had submitted Wiz's fully audited and approved accounting 10 months ago while I was in the hospital. Wiz and Inaugural Productions, IP's, budget had been pre-submitted, approved, and signed off on by Barrick, Gates, Ammerman, and Presidential Inauguration Committee CEO Sarah Armstrong, currently the Vice President of Political Affairs and Federation Relations at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We all left the meeting knowing a lot more than we had walking into it. The next day, as promised, Heather sent an email to Ricky and asked her to share it with me. Why not send it directly to me? Because I was locked out of my government email again, for some strange reason. As discussed yesterday, I told Stephanie I would write two blurbs, said Heather. The first is the suggested response she gives when a reporter calls her, and the second is the suggested for Tom B. Bear in mind, this is specific to SWW. As other, more general questions come in, the responses will be drafted and discussed. Generally, the concept is going to be that this inauguration was consistent with every inauguration in history. We raised more money and spent more money, but the scope was proportional. Let me know what you think. Heather's two blurbs. For me to use with press, it was an honor and privilege to be a part of the most historic inauguration our country has ever witnessed. I was so grateful for the opportunity to help usher in the peaceful transition of power, and I would be humbled to do it again. Beyond that, I would refer any questions to the inaugural committee. For Tom to use when asked about me, we were very fortunate to have someone of Stephanie's caliber on our team. Her exceptional vision transformed our inaugural events into an elegant masterpiece never seen before in the history of inaugurations. She was able to bring a unique style to the events throughout the week that captured the interests of people, not just in the U.S., but around the world. There is no doubt she has raised the bar for future inaugurations to come. It sounded great, but why were these blurbs necessary at all? I didn't need Tom to gush about my aesthetic or justify my work on the inauguration. I willfully decided that all of this was just there watching out for me. In a previous phone call, Tom had told me, "Your name is already linked to the First Lady's. Because you did such a great job on the inauguration, she brought you in to work in her administration. If we don't release your name, you know, it'll look like we're trying to hide something." The press was well aware of my work on behalf of the Presidential Inauguration Committee, as well as my work for the First Lady, despite the White House's never announcing me. It still makes no sense that I was a part of the discussion. I was one of the founding partners in Wiz Media Partners. The 990 lists the top five vendors' company names, not individuals who worked at any of those companies. That kernel in my gut started growing. After the meeting, I called Melania, told her about the meeting with Heather, and said, "This feels off." "What are you worried about?" she said. "You didn't do anything wrong." Later, I texted to her, "Did you get the update from LR, Lindsay Reynolds, about the Heather Martin meeting? I prepared a document from that meeting. Would you like it? I love you. 3 heart emojis, XOXO. Melania replied with a thumbs up emoji, heart emoji, XO, smiling blushing face emoji, and 3 heart emojis, and asked, "What specifics?" Heather told us everything. Lindsay and Ricky were there, but they had no idea of the information that Heather was providing. I have it all now. I'll send you the PDF when I get home. On way to watch Alexi perform and sing. 3 heart emojis, 2 face-blowing kisses emojis, XO. Melania replied with a thumbs up emoji, heart emoji. Have fun and good luck to Alexi. Microphone emoji, treble clef emoji. Ricky and I had some late-night calls and text exchanges that week and talked about how hard it was to balance work and family. The conversation turned to our meeting with Heather Martin. Ricky texted, "I miss the days of picking linens and pretty lighting. I spoke to legal 7 times today," meaning she had spoken to Stefan Pazentino. Why would she need to be speaking with legal? And 7 times? Back in D.C., I went to speak with Ricky alone. We may have had our differences here and there, but we both knew each other to be pure to the core. I closed the double doors to her office behind me and took a seat. I told her I'd begun to feel uneasy about it all. "Take your things and leave," she said. "You don't need to be here." Huh? Was she really telling me to pack up my shit and go home? You're killing yourself, she said. Your heart and loyalty are so deep, you have taken on too much. You can still do your work, but you don't need the headache of the White House. Upset and panicky, I went to see Melania in the residence. Ricky said I need to pack up and leave, I said. What do you mean, she asked. When did she say that to you? Ricky said that I don't need to be at the White House to do the work I'm doing with you. I interpreted the comment as disrespectful to Melania and to me. Were the powers that be kicking me out? Melania assured me that wasn't going to happen. In hindsight, Ricky was just trying to warn me. If I hadn't been so defensive, I might have seen that. Second warning. On January 20th, Heather sent me a link to a Washington Post article about Russian nationals attending inaugural events and wrote, "Here is the article I was mentioning. It just came out. It's not bad at all for 1 month's work and pestering from the Post. Much ado about nothing. It was about Russians at inauguration events who'd gotten tickets from a straw donor." The 990's top five vendors, the chairman's global dinner, and Burnett weren't the only presidential inauguration committee controversies at the moment. Heather told us that Walter Kinsey, CEO of Encore Live, was threatening to sue the presidential inauguration committee for $1.7 million, claiming that the Opening Day Foundation, a nonprofit created by Don Jr., Eric, and their cohorts Thomas O. Hicks, Jr., and Gentry Beach, had hired his firm to produce the concert at the Verizon Center, a.k.a. Camouflage and Cufflinks, and then canceled it. Heather also told me Barrick's lawyer had sent Kinsey a cease and desist letter in response. Heather wrote again on January 22nd and said, "I just had a call with Tom, Douglas Ammerman, and their press people. Tom separately emailed me afterwards and asked for your resume. The direction, I believe, is that they're going to say we brought in the best of the best of the best." Once again, I had to wonder why Tom's press team needed to know anything more about me. What more did they need? Why was I the direction? My reaction was to stall. I didn't send my resume as requested, and Heather nudged me about it. Melania, Pamela Gross, and I met in the First Lady's East Wing office to talk about initiative matters. The First Lady was sitting at her desk. Pam and I were in chairs facing her. I said, "I don't know what the fuck is going on." They sat there looking at me with puppy dog eyes. "I'm worried about the inauguration filing and all these emails from Heather." "I'm not worried about you," said Melania. "You will be fine." "The truth is the truth," I replied, and slumped down in the chair. I heaved a sigh of relief. Gesturing to the three of us, she added, "We all know the truth. We'll all protect you." What did I need protection from, though? "Do I need to hire a lawyer?" I asked. "Yes, you should have one," said Melania. "You did nothing wrong." The room fell into silence. And then, out of nowhere, the chair Pamela was sitting on broke and she fell straight to the floor. She's a tiny woman. That chair was not even fit for a bird. We burst out laughing. It was a deep laughter, filled with relief but also born out of dread. Her falling was a sign that the proverbial shit was about to hit the proverbial fan and we were all about to be thrown on our asses, myself included. Who in the Presidential Inauguration Committee would fall on theirs over the 990? The next day, I connected with a lawyer, a partner at Paul, Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, the same firm that had run an internal investigation about Roger Ailes at Fox News and Harvey Weinstein at the Weinstein Company. I felt I was in good hands with him, and from that point on, I didn't make a move without his counsel. I was a political neophyte who had stepped right into the center of one of the most divisive political and ideological battles this country has ever known, and I didn't like what was happening around me. Final warning. On January 30th, I received a document from Heather that became known as the 67 Questions. The document was being prepared and was approved for release by the family and other operatives affiliated with the White House. The timing of the release was being handled by Heather, Hope Hicks, and Grisham. It was a list of press questions about the inauguration the West Wing Communication Shop had received and compiled, and ignored for the last year, and their cookie-cutter answers. I don't think Heather was supposed to send me the entire document, but she did. Rick Gates had his own section. Question number 32. What did Rick Gates have to do with the Presidential Inauguration Committee? The White House answer? Need answer. Question number 33. Was Rick Gates in charge of the Presidential Inauguration Committee money? The White House answer, no. Question number 34. Are there any outstanding Presidential Inauguration Committee issues related to Rick Gates or Presidential Inauguration Committee money he handled? The White House answer, no. And that was the moment I realized that there was a major problem. Gates had had everything to do with the money. Reading ahead, I found a section about me personally, not Wiz Media Partners. My name was not supposed to appear on any Presidential Inauguration Committee documents, but there it was, all by its lonesome self. The Wiz partners' names were nowhere to be found, and neither was Inaugural Productions. To make matters worse, all of the information was wrong. Dates, details, amounts, the scope of my work, and major clarifications needed to be noted. I got to work making the changes in consultation with my attorney and my partners, John and Mel, and even Melania. She read everything. Melania herself addressed the potentially controversial question, is Wolkoff a good friend of the First Lady? And suggested I cross the word good out of the question. At the time, I assumed it was to protect myself from a cronyism charge. I sent back a heavily redlined document that set the record straight, with Melania's edits too, to Heather in good time and with a good faith understanding that they'd use them. We are not going to pile until next Thursday or Friday to coincide with the next round of the government shutdown possibility, Heather informed me. So their strategy was to bury the release during the shutdown? I wasn't so sure that would work. The information had to be corrected in any event. Heather said, I got your corrections. I'm going to talk to Tommy Davis again this morning and tell him we need to release to a friendly. She meant a friendly journalist who would tell the story the way they wanted it to be told. We have to get ahead of it. There were two more articles yesterday wondering where the money is. By the money, did she mean the $80 million plus of the $107 million in inaugural donations that hadn't been adequately accounted for yet? The only money that we knew had been accounted for was Wiz's budget, most of which had been transferred to Inaugural Productions for the concert and the balls. On January 31st, I had no time to think about the 990. We were on the last push for the initiative presentation. I felt like a child telling Melania, I asked Lindsay for your official pictures so I could incorporate into the presentation. Didn't get it. I also asked for your past year of visits to schools and hospitals so I could use as the guideline. Melania's response felt distant and cold. She said she would need to look for pictures herself. Just do without them. Get it done. It was a command. After our listening session in the East Wing, the West Wing's interest in our initiative was heating up. All of a sudden, everyone is so interested in your initiatives because of the experts on your team. Yale, Mark Brackett, Robin Stern, Tim Shriver, a real Kennedy, I wrote. All this started right after our meeting. Lindsay had reached out to Jared's Office of American Innovation to inform them of what we were doing, which made no sense, unless Ivanka intended to swoop in at the last minute and usurp the First Lady's initiative right out from under her, or at the very least, sabotage it. I alerted the designated White House ethics czar, Stefan Pazantino, about all of it. He was a lawyer. I could trust him, right? Wrong. I'd later learned that Stefan was a part of the family. The only reason he showed up and gave us such a hard time is because of my email. I'd given him the inside scoop without even realizing what I'd done. Jared, Ivanka, the whole West Wing, and the East Wing for that matter, were sick of my trying to make the First Lady look good. I told Melania, they all want me out of the way. She knew I was right. But I didn't give up. On February 8th, Pamela and I made a detailed, evidence-based presentation to the East Wing staff that succinctly laid out the initiative and our month's work of research in partnership with experts. I highlighted the phrases, children should be seen and not heard, with a cross-out symbol over the word not. We wrote easy-to-remember rules like, think before you hit send, and if you feel something, say something, and walk through the steps of ending the cycle of silence to teach kids the skills they needed to understand their emotions and to instill positive feelings in them about themselves, the keys to stopping bullying and addiction. The staff sat in chairs in a semicircle. Melania sat right in front of me in the middle of the room. But she was different. She looked like a queen on her throne waiting for us all to kiss the ring. Halfway through my presentation, Stephanie Grisham got up, left, and never came back. Melania didn't bat an eyelash, which seemed so strange. Grisham's rudeness actually gave me a moment to pause and reflect on the image on my computer screen. The Frederick Douglass quote, "It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." Everyone stared at me blankly, so I kept going and finished the unveiling of the First Lady's initiative. I asked Pamela, seated in the back, if she had anything to add. She gave me a supportive smile, but didn't speak. Everyone filed out of our office. Melania was last. Pamela and I congratulated her. She'd lived and breathed every step of the way with us. We were proud of our work and honored to have served our friend. Melania was all smiles, but something was off. Pamela and I accompanied Melania on the 3-minute walk from her office in the East Wing to the residence elevator. At the same time, Donald walked over from the West Wing. The four of us stopped at the elevator, Melania standing between Pamela and me. Donald kept 2 feet back from us, legs clamped together. I could have sworn I heard his heels click, and arms at his sides. He said, "Hello, ladies." Usually when Donald saw Pamela and me, he greeted us with a big smile and hug and a few pleasantries. This greeting was cold and abrupt. Melania smiled, stepped into the elevator with him, and gave us the British royal wave she'd mastered. I brushed it off. Surely he had more pressing things on his mind than being his jovial self. But his behavior was markedly different. For some reason, the 990 popped into my head. Pamela and I did an about-face and walked back to our office in the East Wing, closed the door, hoping no one would hear us, and sat down in disbelief. We stared at each other for about a minute. She said, "What was that?" Later that night, Melania texted to thank me for the meeting and to ask if there was anything I needed from her or if I had any questions. I replied, "I just received an email about the government shutdown. I am not allowed to come into the White House. Only your staff can come. So I won't be able to work in the office while I'm here. However, shall I arrange with Tim, Harleth, the White House usher, to come as a visitor to residence?" She said she'd take care of it. "I will let Timothy know. See you at 10:30. That day, February 9, 2018, the approved Presidential Inauguration Committee press release arrived in my inbox. It was bland and generic and intentionally vague on the burning question, how was the $107 million spent? This is the largest amount ever raised for a presidential inauguration committee. All of the funds were raised from private sources and no taxpayer money was expended for any presidential inauguration committee activities, it said. The underlying message was classic Trump, biggest amount ever. But that didn't provide substantive details about where the money had gone. Thomas Barrack's quote, "This inauguration represented the hallmark of American democracy in the unique and cherished American tradition of a peaceful transition of power from the president to the president-elect. The day of the 50th presidential inauguration, as well as the more than 20 events surrounding it, was conceived, planned, financed, staffed, and executed in 69 days. And it was executed in elegance and seamless excellence without incident or interruption, befitting the legacy and tradition that has preceded us." There were echoes of that first lunch I had had with him and Rick Gates at Le Bilboquet about excellence and legacy. I'd been suckered then, and now here he was smooth-talking the American people. The release also stated that millions had been donated to charities, such as the American Red Cross, Samaritan's Purse, the Salvation Army, the Smithsonian Institution, and the White House Historical Association. My name was not mentioned. I exhaled weeks of stress. By evening, the statement had not been sent to the media. I asked Heather about the delay, and she said, "We are still tracking a release tomorrow, but we are waiting the final green light by Hope Hicks." I told her TB Tom Barrack left me several messages. Melania texted at 7:55 p.m., suddenly all eager to see my responses to the questions. She asked to see the ones that pertained to her ASAP. She also told me that Grisham and Barrack needed more time to ready the PR, so they weren't releasing anything that day. "Please send me my Q&A for pick, so I approve it." I had been double-checking her answers. "Show me mine," she demanded. I wondered if I'd set off some alarms when I sent back the 67 questions with all that redlining. It had been approved by my lawyer. I shouldn't have spoken with Stefan Pazentino, who, unbeknownst to me at the time, was Ivanka's ethics lawyer, and shared my feelings about the Presidential Inauguration Committee with him. Had I shown my hand too soon by demonstrating to Tom, Donald, Melania, and the powers that be that I was not, and would never be, prepared to just look the other way? Whatever they wanted the narrative to be, I was not on the same page. On February 12th, I sent Melania an email containing a draft of her message from FLOTUS and asked her what she thought about the name Speak Up, plus plus plus. I still believed Be Best wasn't the best. At 5:30 p.m., she texted tersely that she was just finishing her meetings. We'll go over tonight. On February 13th, Tuesday, Heather emailed, all jazzed up. Spoke to Tommy Davis, convinced him we need to go all in and be proactive. I am tweaking the press release they wrote and trying to get some surrogates ready to speak positive. Later, she emailed about the journalist they'd given the exclusive to. Heather's text read, "We're all set, moving forward on Thursday, 2 days hence. The plan is that Maggie Haberman of the New York Times will run the story on Thursday per Tom Barrack. Depending on whom you talk to, Haberman was either tough on Donald Trump or a complete suck-up to him. That didn't matter. The issue was Haberman's relationship with Tom Barrack. According to Heather, Haberman was a friendly. She would present the story the Presidential Inauguration Committee wanted the world to read." She continued, "And they will also give the package to Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham at Fox News. I didn't know anything about a package. This was all making me very nervous." Heather kept me up to date on everything. "The 990 report is officially filed," she texted at 11 p.m. "We're starting to get questions. The New York Times will likely be the first story." She said Tommy Davis was making sure that my credentials would be emphasized in the articles. Huh? But my name hadn't been on the press release. I pulled up Google and began searching for the report. "I can't find it," I texted Heather. "Are you sure it was filed?" She said, "The IRS might not post it for months, but the federal law states that the moment it is placed in a mailbox, we are legally required to provide the public copy." I asked her, "Where does the public copy go?" "Public copy is just held and provided as people ask for it." Does she think the story about how Trump spent $107 million isn't going to hit every major network around the world? On February 14th, Melania and I texted repeatedly about Be Best and the launch that was coming up in just a couple of weeks. "They're sending me a new Be Best logo," I texted. "I will send the whole deck to only you when I am finished." Melania was all thumbs up emoji. I sent her the complete Be Best presentation that evening. Months of work, a true labor of love, the dream I'd had when I first joined forces with Melania. She texted at 10 p.m. to thank me for sending my 8 pages of summary and to say she would go over them. "Busy day. We'll talk to you tomorrow." She directed me to combine social media and cyberbullying so that the initiative had only 3 points: well-being, social media, and opioids. She signed off with, "Happy Valentine's Day." To say I was crestfallen would be an understatement. Suddenly, the truth hit me like a ton of bricks. I'd been under such enormous pressure from all sides, I hadn't realized those feelings were because of her, too. I felt resentment. She decided it was easier to toe the line than step out of line. I wish she would have told me. After all the battles I'd fought to do this, the attitudes and roadblocks, the lack of resources and no staff, not to mention the West Wing hurdles, just to get her initiative off the ground, there was a reason behind the tension and defensiveness I was feeling. I was offended and disheartened. I thought about the question my mom had once asked me. "What would you tell your daughter to do if you saw her suffering the way I see you?" She was right, and she wasn't alone. She, Bruce, David, my children, my brothers, my in-laws, and my friends all saw the emotional and physical toll working for Melania took on me, and it begged me to walk away from that toxic environment. They worried about my overall health and well-being. How ironic. I made a promise to them all that as soon as I delivered Melania's initiative to her, I would walk away. Until then, I would bear the daily onslaught of hate, resentment, humiliation, and antagonistic behavior. Bullying, really. I promised my mom I'd check in daily. "Dear Mom," I wrote, "so proud, so sad," and attached the final deck for Melania's initiative. "I adore you. Tomorrow will be Bubby and Papa's anniversary. All will be good," she replied. I felt somewhat relieved. I had delivered on my promise both to the First Lady of the United States and to my family and friends. I inhaled deeply with dignity and grace and then drafted my resignation letter at 11:44 p.m. that night. "Dear Melania, as I sit here tonight, I'm thinking about the past year and a half. I willingly opened my heart and sacrificed my health, my family, my relationships, my companies. I accepted the roles with honor to produce the inauguration and work with you on everything, despite the intense hostility everywhere, followed by my role at the White House when no one else was there and I was taking care of it all alone. I would do it all over again for you. I could go on and on, but you have heard it all already. Your staff, Lindsay and Stephanie, are horribly disrespectful, and I can no longer be a part of such a toxic environment. Not only are they abrasive and hostile, but they do it passive-aggressively. They only share what they want, and they don't collaborate. They just speak down to me and not speak with me. I am heartbroken, truly heartbroken, that these people, who couldn't care less about anything but their resumes and next job, have made sure not to include me when I ask every day to be called or conferenced in, but then use all my work. I haven't taken care of my health, spent time with my children, or enjoyed even a walk outside because I wanted to make sure you had it all complete for a perfect rollout in every area. I can't believe these people have won. They are in control of everything and want to glide on by. They have completely stripped me of my dignity, and I can't be treated like a subordinate by someone with no experience. I love you with all my heart and will be here always. I really love the initiatives because so much of it was personal about my difficult journey with Zach. This was a way to heal. All for what? So they can stand there and applaud themselves? We did all the work. This has nothing to do with me wanting to leave. It has to do with them making me leave. I am speechless. You are my best friend, and this isn't what I ever wanted. I'm so dedicated to you, always and forever. XOXO, I love you, Stephanie. CoverGirl strikes again. I woke up the next morning, February 15th, 2018, to see my name and picture splashed across the front page of the New York Times website under an article headline, "Trump's Inaugural Committee Paid $26 Million to First Lady's Friend," by Maggie Haberman and Kenneth P. Vogel. With those 10 words, life as I knew it ended. Sitting at my desk alcove in my kitchen, I stared at the screen in disbelief. I kept hitting refresh, hoping it'd go away. The comments on the article started racking up, all of them hostile, hateful, and negative. By the headline alone, it seemed like the First Lady had handed her party planner friend a cushy job and that I had danced off with millions. It made our friendship the big scandal. I was freaking out. Heather said, "Seriously, just annoyed at all the stupid spin. They write a perfectly boring article, but they paste your face on it to draw readers. The article was filled with lies." "Look, it's hard to be on the receiving end," Heather said. "Even Rick is behind the scenes telling reporters to get your record straight. All the while, he has his own fake news out today." "Did you really think Rick was innocent of the Mueller charges?" Poor deluded Heather. The article said that Wiz Media Partners had been created in December 2016, about 6 weeks before the inauguration, and its founder, according to a person familiar with the firm, was Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, a longtime friend of Mrs. Trump's. Otherwise, there was very little information available about the company. It implied that I had only gotten the job because of Melania, and that I'd just opened some rinky-dink party planning company for the very first time. No slam on party planners, but my life's work has been about producing large-scale epic events, the Met Gala, Fashion Week, and raising millions for scientific research and the emotional wellness of children. Also, it read as if I alone had created Wiz Media Partners. John and Tiny Horse, or any of the other partners, were never mentioned. Personally, I was characterized as a rich white lady society dilettante. Miss Winston Wolkoff made her name planning Manhattan society galas. An associate of the Vogue editor Anna Winter, Miss Winston Wolkoff traveled in the same circles as Mrs. Trump, who attended Miss Winston Wolkoff's 40th birthday party in 2010. Miss Winston Wolkoff has subsequently been brought on as a senior advisor to the First Lady's official government office. Oh, I was a name dropper, too. Two people with direct knowledge of Miss Winston Wolkoff's role, who asked to remain anonymous, said she often invoked Mrs. Trump's name with transition officials as she delivered instructions for the inauguration. No shit. I was working for Melania. I was delivering her instructions for her husband's inauguration. I was interviewing her staff. Should I not have mentioned her name? The two anonymous sources? Take your pick. Lindsay was no fan of mine. Grisham, obviously. Hope Hicks. Heather Martin. Tommy Davis. Ivanka. I'm sure they had all spoken to Haberman. Miss Winston Walkoff could not be reached for comment, the article claimed. Not true. Haberman and Vogel never called, texted, or emailed me. This part killed me. Stephanie Grisham, a spokesperson for Mrs. Trump, said the First Lady had no involvement with the inaugural committee and had no knowledge of how funds were spent. Complete and utter horseshit. Melania knew it all, every detail, including who screwed around, the type of salmon served at the candlelight dinner, the inconsistencies in Hargrove's budgets, and approving those Tiffany bowls. And she was the one who told me, regarding our quest for talent, I don't think Donald likes Kenny Rogers. According to Miss Grisham, said the article, Miss Winston Walkoff is classified as a special government employee and has special duties as outlined in her contract. Per the contract, I'd paid a heap of money to prepare. I was an unpaid trusted advisor. An operative, the piece continued, who worked with the inaugural committee, who was not authorized to speak for attribution about its spending, said Miss Winston Walkoff personally received $1.62 million for her work through a consulting firm. My head exploded right there, all over my white kitchen walls. People would read these falsehoods and believe them. I was completely unprepared for this. They wanted to pin the whole thing on me. No, correction, they had pinned it on me. I sat in front of my computer screen most of the day with fast-striking PTSD. Per the New York Times article, an inaugural committee official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the official was not authorized to discuss the details publicly, said Miss Winston Walkoff's firm also paid the team used by Mark Burnett, referring to IP, the creator of The Prentice, whose involvement in the inaugural festivities was requested by Mr. Trump. For the record, my personal compensation for my work on the inauguration that I retained was $480,000. That number seems like a lot. It is a lot. But to put it into perspective, imagine we had been making a $107 million movie. Producers' fees are typically 5%, and sometimes they are as high as 10%. My fee was less than half of 1%. Many people working on the inauguration made far more than I did. Only after I went ballistic did Heather Martin and Tommy Davis tell me they'd try to help me and clear up the confusion that they'd caused with the Times. Later in the article, it was stated that, although committee officials said that she used the money to help pay other inaugural workers who reported to her, but it was already too late. I don't need to defend my compensation. I'm a well-paid professional and I worked extremely hard, as I always do. I didn't take a penny to work with Melania during the transition or the inauguration, and for the year we spent together in the White House. I gave up my career. I gave up every partnership. I gave up my salary and title at the White House so that I could hire much-needed help and to support our initiatives. I landed in the hospital for a month and almost died. I was not in this to get rich. And if you take into account the amount of money I have now spent on attorney fees to defend myself, I'm in the hole almost $1 million. It was the worst mistake of my life to get involved with Melania and the Trumps. Emotionally, mentally, physically, financially, socially, professionally. I thought I had an amazing friend, but when it really counted, Melania wasn't there for me. It suddenly became painfully clear to me that she wasn't really my friend, in the true sense of the word. This reputation-decimating smear in the New York Times, the so-called paper of record, was the price I paid for my devotion, and it was too high. It cost me the reputation I'd built for 20-plus years in media and entertainment. I knew instantly the damage was extensive. Emails and texts were flooding in from journalists asking for comment, a courtesy the Times had not extended, but not from friends and colleagues. I think they were embarrassed for me and didn't know what to say. I texted Melania with a link to the story. Urgent, read this. I sent an email to Grisham, CCing Lindsay, Melania, and Pazentino. Can you please explain to me why you would tell the press that I am a special government employee and a contracted volunteer? I have a gratuitous service agreement attached. I am a trusted advisor and have worked on all of the initiatives. Grisham had gone apeshit after the UN luncheon when Katie Rogers asked me to define my role. She said I was not allowed to answer any questions about my title or agreement. And now she was spouting incorrect information to the Times. The distinction in title language and the type of contract is important. a special government employee is hired by the federal government for a temporary, specific job. A contractor is also hired for a specific project. If I had been one of those, I would have gotten a contract and been paid, like David Mann had been. My agreement was not with the federal government, nor could I be a contractor, because my role was too broad. It did not relate to a specific task and had no set time frame. Grisham and other forces in the White House didn't want people to know that I'd been working for the First Lady for more than a year on every aspect of her work. Grisham replied, "I cleared all that I said through legal. I've been inundated with questions as to the unique nature of your employment situation here at the White House. This messaging is the best way to go in order to minimize the negative press stories of today and to protect FLOTUS and this administration." Removing Mrs. Trump's personal email from this exchange. She didn't want Melania to see communications. The next day, I fired off an email to legal, aka Stefan Pasentino. Stephanie G admitted that she lied and said she did so to do what is best to minimize the negative press stories of today and protect FLOTUS and this administration. Freedom of Information Act? The inaugural stories are fake news. Heather Martin knows all of this, and so does Lindsay, who spoke with Heather and me, I wrote. I'm a dedicated and loyal friend to FLOTUS. Everyone knows the truth about the inauguration. All the fake news around me is to deflect attention. For the East Wing staff to treat me this way is wrong. I'm surprised you didn't call me or speak with me when I told you 2 weeks ago that I had information to share with you about the inauguration. I have removed everyone else from this email. You can decide who to share it with. Friendly Haberman had taken an exclusive from the operatives who had asked to remain anonymous, and it made me the scapegoat for suspicious inaugural accounting. I was the perfect distraction from the real story. The scores of millions that were insufficiently accounted for. Not one reporter was questioning the people who did the Presidential Inauguration Committee financing. It was unbelievable. Was I just collateral damage, or had someone set me up for this fall? Who would want to hurt me so badly? For that matter, was I the real target, or was I being used to discredit Melania by association? I texted Melania, "Tom fucked me over. He made me the headline." She replied, 4 pouting face emojis, and later, "Hope you are okay and talk to your lawyer." You bet I did. He and I talked about next steps. I wanted to sue the Times for defamation and provide every scrap of paper that proved the story's inaccuracies. But if I did, the Presidential Inauguration Committee could sue me. I'd signed a non-disclosure agreement that barred me from talking about my work on the inauguration. I was stuck, and the Presidential Inauguration Committee and Trump knew it. It must have been part of the setup. I'm able to write about some things now because these events have been investigated and reported on. I can comment on what's in the public record. What I've written about that happened between Melania and me during this time wasn't under an NDA. My mind was spinning. In the middle of my meltdown, I received calls from Heather and Tommy Davis, who were dealing with the press on this. Sometime during the course of that horrific day, the Times headline changed to "Trump Inaugural Committee Paid $26 Million to Firm of First Lady's Advisor," adding "firm of" and changing "friend" to "advisor." The Times ditched the original defaming headline, but I have a screenshot, and it exists in the annals of Reddit. Tommy told me, "We worked very hard to clear up the misconception about the $1.6 million and to make clear your incredible reputation and outstanding qualifications to be picked for the job you did." Heather said the headline change was a slight improvement, but the lies in the body of the piece were unchanged. The paper never issued a retraction or an apology. If I hadn't taken a screenshot of the original headline, I would have no record of it. But it got out there and thousands of people saw it nevertheless. Outlets around the world picked up the story. My face and name became synonymous with Trumpian self-dealing, graft, cronyism, and avarice. People believed I was the antithesis of the woman I actually was. Most still do. The Trumps were experts at perception, so they had to know what this would do to me. I knew who I really was, but my identity had been stolen. The dichotomy was like being torn in half. The humiliation of the article triggered in me a terror of leaving my house. My family was upset for me, of course, and tried to empathize with how cataclysmically devastated I was. Unless you've been wrongly, publicly shamed, it's hard to understand how seismic it feels when your core self is demolished. What a fool I was, thinking I could make a difference in the middle of this den of thieves. That day, I remember staring at the screen for hours, hitting refresh on a Google search of my name, reading all the tweets, not able to stop myself. My body was racked with chills, covered in goosebumps. At one point, I crumbled into a ball on the floor and sobbed and cried out in anguish like a wounded animal. My only comfort was a cozy black sweatshirt that was big enough to bury my face in. In my head, I turned it into a life vest, the only thing that was keeping me afloat. I didn't take it off for days. Melania ghosted me. She didn't comment on my resignation letter for 2 long days. Finally, she texted, "How are you? Did you talk to your lawyer?" She and I spoke for hours about how my lawyers were handling this, and the day after that, and the day after that, "Did you talk to your lawyer?" Melania's nerd face emojis, squinting face with tongue emojis, heart emojis, and kiss emojis had been replaced with lawyer, lawyer, lawyer. Nothing personal, just business. Meanwhile, Clown Prince Jared still didn't have security clearance to do classified work, and yet, there he was doing it every day. On February 16th, The Times reported that General John F. Kelly, Donald's chief of staff, had ordered an overhaul of all White House security clearances. It wasn't just Jared. Presidential aide Rob Porter had somehow gotten FBI clearance to work in the White House, despite the agency's knowledge that he'd been accused of domestic violence. They'd let a twice-accused wife-beater in the White House? No problem. But they'd escorted my potential hire out of the building for smoking pot once, decades ago. Part of the fallout from General Kelly's sweeping overhaul was his decision to cancel all contracts for volunteers, which included my gratuitous service agreement. It'd been signed only 6 months before. If Melania had just accepted my resignation, which she never acknowledged, ever, I would have had the dignity to say, "I quit." I genuinely believed, as did Mark and Robin, doctors, therapists, professors, researchers, and experts, that Melania wanted to affect change. Melania wanted to focus on cyberbullying and be a good digital citizen in today's world. Her mission was to stop individuals from hiding behind their screens to protect their identity. I wanted this initiative to succeed against all odds and was willing to keep fighting for the greater good. She'd always ask me, "Why do you care so much?" I had to care for the both of us until I realized how much she didn't really care at all. While loyalty was everything to the Trumps, honesty was everything to me. Melania didn't respect me enough or have the decency to tell me the truth to my face or to pick up the phone and call me to tell me everything I'd predicted was coming true and that she was playing a role in it all. She hid behind a screen, dropping the news via email in a letter addressed to Pamela and me. No disrespect to Pamela, but Melania could have taken the time to send me my own letter. I couldn't believe what I was reading. "Dear Stephanie and Pamela, I know you both received a call from the White House and that it was not news that you wanted. I will call each of you personally later this evening, but wanted to reach out immediately to express my gratitude for all that you have done. The decision to terminate all gratuitous service contracts was made on a professional level by the White House Counsel and was not a personal attack or reflection on either of you. I consider you both my friends and appreciate all that you have done for me. I am sorry that the professional part of our relationship has come to an end, but I am comforted in the fact that our friendship far outweighs politics. Thank you again. Much love, Melania." Much love? From the tone of her letter, she expected me to buck up and be on my way, with my reputation stomped to bits and without a place on the initiative we'd worked so hard to accomplish. I was asking her to defend me, to clarify what I'd done for her and what she knew about the inauguration. Since friendship far outweighs politics, as this almost certainly White House written letter said, she should help me clear my name by just telling the truth. As I was reading the letter, Stefan Pazentino called. He said, "The White House has made a decision globally that we are going to be terminating all gratuitous service agreements. This is not personal, and this is not related to you, and the decision was made by the President, the First Lady, and the White House that there's just too much risk involved with folks who are not special government employees. I just wanted to call you and let you know, because I didn't want you to hear that from anyone else, and make sure that you knew that this is not personal." "This is because of the bullshit New York Times story," I exclaimed. "You know firsthand that's a cover-up." Stefan said, "I can't speak to any of that." This is going to make it look as though I was fired, I said. I don't want you to think that this has anything to do with Pick, so this is not personal, he said. We're not going to do any press or anything with it, but it's a decision we made at a White House-wide level to make sure we're not going to do this kind of contract. You didn't do anything wrong, and there's nothing wrong with this kind of contract. It's just that the decision was made to operate this way going forward. No one else had ever done an agreement like the one my former lawyers, who, unbeknownst to me at the time, were also representing Trump, had drawn up in consultation with the White House. It was the first of its kind, probably because no one else would be as eager and foolish as I was to beg to work for free with no protections. But it wasn't the last. Pamela Gross had the exact same agreement as I did. Pamela's contract was discontinued too, he said. They are both ended. This was another key factor that, if were disclosed to the public, would have exonerated me. It proved that this type of contract was being discontinued and had nothing to do with the pick. But since the White House insisted on not releasing the details, the public would believe I was fired because of the bogus claims made by the New York Times. Melania called while I was on with Stefan. After I hung up with the lawyer, I called her back. I can't believe this, I said. Stephanie, I know you're upset and so am I. I don't blame you. Stefan told me I'm to stop working on everything. I have no role. I know I'd sent my resignation letter to Melania the night before the New York Times story broke, but it's one thing to ask to leave and expect a transition period to wind down, and another to be severed and kicked out immediately. The lawyers say you can't work under this kind of contract, she said. I finally lost it. You know this isn't right. And you also know it makes no sense. The White House is going to make up the story they want to protect all their asses. The narrative was so juicy. They knew the press and public would eat it up. Even though it was a blatant distortion of the facts, they let it fly. Melania's friend got $26 million and was fired because of it. You have to make it right, I pleaded. My contract was discontinued due to security clearances. But you know people will assume I got fired because of the PIC financing. I told Melania that Stefan had said it wasn't personal and that it had nothing to do with the Presidential Inauguration Committee. He'd also claimed that the White House was not going to comment. You know that's bullshit, I told her. On February 23rd, Rick Gates, someone my business partners and I had been forced to work with, pled guilty to lying and conspiracy against the United States. It didn't surprise me. Light was slowly being cast on the deceptions that were creeping into every corner of the inauguration, the transition, America First policies, and the West Wing. These men left a trail of bread loaves behind them, leading investigators right to their doors. I could only surmise that the price for informing Donald and Melania about the irregularities and problems in executing my overload of work for the inauguration was becoming the cover girl for the inauguration shenanigans, and having my name soiled by the New York Times. Teflon Don was left completely unscathed as the best people were arrested, fired, and disgraced for their association with him. Logically, you would think the New York Times would have been investigating the overspending and asking about the other $80 million+ spent by the Presidential Inauguration Committee, the majority of the money, and the possible corruption of the Presidential Inauguration Committee under the stewardship of Rick Gates. But as Melania would say, nope. Instead, on February 25th, I received a text from Ken Bogle, the co-author of the defamatory article. Hey, Stephanie, he wrote, we are writing a story on the First Lady's office firing you from your unpaid job as a result of the president's displeasure with the news that your firm was paid $26 million by the Presidential Inauguration Committee. Wondering if you wanted to comment and or provide context. Immediately, I texted Melania and said, my inbox is flooded with this. I would like to know how you plan on responding. Melania didn't reply. Her plan for responding was to do nothing. Under the advisement of my lawyer, I emailed Vogel. I encourage you to carefully evaluate your sources and proceed with caution. Please do not exaggerate the facts or rely on false information and innuendo. I do not know why you and others seem to be trying to cause me reputational harm, but I do know that it is completely unfair. I am proud of the work that we did to support the inauguration. Second detonation. The second New York Times story was published on February 26th, 10 days after the first Times story and 6 days after my contract ended. Same picture, new headline. Melania Trump parts ways with advisor amid backlash over inaugural contract, by Kenneth P. Vogel and Maggie Haberman. They take in another shot, this one straight to the kneecap. The first lady, Melania Trump, has parted ways with an advisor after the news about the advisor's firm reaping $26 million in payments to help plan President Trump's inauguration, it said. Stephanie Grisham, Mrs. Trump's spokeswoman, said the office had severed the gratuitous services contract with Ms. Wolkoff, who Ms. Grisham said had been employed as a special government employee to work on specific projects. We thank her for her hard work and wish her all the best. Severed? I emailed Grisham, grabbing at my throat reflexively. It was a violent word. Keeping the response short and professional, confirming the contract had been severed, thanking you for all your hard work and wishing you the best, she replied. Their intention was to smear my name and long-standing credibility by implying that I had been chopped from the White House due to my role in the inauguration. I was not a special government employee. I was not hired for one task for a specific period of time. I was contracted to be an advisor for as long as Melania and I cared to continue. I know I sound like a broken record, but this detail was more critical than ever. The White House lawyers repeatedly claimed I couldn't be given a proper contract and salary because my work was open-ended. But now they were firing me because my work was open-ended? Damned if I do, damned if I don't. Any way you slice it, I lose. The article claimed that two people with direct knowledge of the situation said that my contract termination was prompted by displeasure from the Trumps over the news, first reported by the New York Times, that a firm created by Ms. Winston Wolkoff was paid nearly $26 million for event planning by a nonprofit group that oversaw Mr. Trump's inauguration and surrounding events in January 2017. Donald and Melania had repeatedly told David Mann and me that we were doing a great job. I was now living in a completely alternative universe. David was dragged into this too. The New York Times reported that Mr. Trump was reportedly enraged by the payment and by the news that Ms. Winston Wolkoff had paid an associate, David Mann, $3.7 million to help plan the festivities. I didn't pay anyone a penny. I wasn't paid $26 million. I wasn't a part of the approval process, and I didn't have access to the financing, not even Wiz's. Every budget was pre-approved and authorized by Tom, Rick, Sarah, and the PIC Finance Committee. David and I worked on the candlelight dinner with Melania and had Donald's input, and we then helped renovate the East Wing and executive residence together. David had a contract with the White House as a contractor, hired for a specific project with a start and end date. So, in this story, written by the New York Times again, just like the first two stories by Maggie Haberman and Ken Vogel, there are no quotes from Donald or Melania. Just a source, operatives, and people who asked to remain anonymous. Wow. Melania explained to me, we didn't say it. The lawyers, they say we have to do it this way. Oh, I see. The lawyers made the president and first lady not tell the truth. That explains it. At least this time, the New York Times could say that they had called me, and they included a comment from me in the article. I was informed by the White House counsel's office that all gratuitous volunteer contracts were ended. But I couldn't say more because of my NDA. Vogel didn't mention that Pamela Gross's contract had also been severed. If he had, then the story that mine had been severed because of the PIC financing would have been proven bogus. Tragically, it was my friends, Melania and Pamela, who insisted Pamela's involvement in contract remain a secret. The follow-up article said I had been introduced to Tom Barrack by Melania. Also not true. I was introduced to him by Ivanka Trump. Her name was mysteriously absent from this story. Dragging my name and photo in front of the public again, this time about my firing, was an effective distraction from the real and totally embarrassing stories that were unfolding at the White House. The Mueller indictments, other investigations underway, the security clearance debacle. I would have given almost anything to have had Melania's coldness at that time to protect me from the wolves. But I couldn't stop myself from caring. I was way too sensitive for that. You weren't fired, seriously. I just couldn't let it go. I couldn't let the lie stand. I emailed Stefan, who promised there would be no comment from the White House, and demanded to know why he had allowed Grisham to say severed, knowing its implication, knowing the truth about both Pamela and me. He said he'd get back to me. I'm still waiting. How could you let Stephanie Grisham say I was severed? I asked Melania. You know what it means. The contract ended, she replied. No, severed means you cut my head off, fired me. Don't be so dramatic. You weren't fired, she said. She had never spoken to me with such contempt and impatience before in over 15 years of friendship. I'd been in a meeting and I didn't know she was going to say that. The next day, I begged Melania, please clear my name. The day after that, you know I was thrown under the bus for nothing. At least be straight with me after all these years of friendship. All you have to do is tell the truth and stand up for your loyal friend. No one else was there for you like I was. How can you let this be? Finally, on March 2nd, 5 days after she'd allowed the world to believe I was fired for displeasing the first couple, she texted, I know you are still angry and upset. You bet your ass I was. She had been informed by the White House counsel that because of the possible investigations into the Presidential Inauguration Committee's finances, she was not allowed to say anything on my behalf. The American people had been told that she and the president had no involvement in the planning of events or how the Presidential Inauguration Committee spent its money. That triggered an epic letter-writing session that went on for hours. I couldn't put my feelings in a text. As Tom would say, I had to craft and sculpt a response and let her know just how angry and upset I still was. Melania, only you can repair this terrible injustice to me, my reputation, and my integrity by issuing a statement. I know the lawyers told you not to comment, but the facts speak for themselves, and you can say something for me. You are the First Lady, and you have the authority to take care of this. You know I would do this for you 100 times over. My family and friends, the ones who still talk to me, are horrified by your silence. There is no excuse for you not to defend me. If Grisham had just repeated what Stefan told me, you've done nothing wrong and this had nothing to do with the Presidential Inauguration Committee, none of this would be happening and I would not be begging for your help. The moment you saw that headline, you should have issued a statement of your complete acknowledgement of my work, my integrity, and my loyalty to you, POTUS, and the country. You know that. The silence from you is deafening and unfair. Only you can fix this. I love you. Love, Stephanie. I challenged her about saying she and Donald were displeased with me and David Mann. She said, the lawyers made me and Donald say that. I would defend you, but I don't want to break the law. What law says you are forbidden from defending a falsely accused and devoted friend? This was Melania Trump, a woman who does what she wants and what suits her own interests. In this case, that meant letting powerful forces, one, discredit me, two, get rid of me, and three, destroy me. By not protecting me, which she had promised to do, she was a tacit accomplice. I'd been there for her. Whatever she asked for, whatever she needed, I supplied. The one time I asked for a precious thing, for her to speak the truth, she left my corner, leaving me bleeding in the ring. When it really counted, Melania wasn't there for me. She wasn't really my friend. In fact, I wish I'd never met her.